We brethren, along with our Anabaptist cousins, the Mennonites, are known for our frugality. Now, frugality is a polite way of saying cheapskates. It is said that copper wire was invented when a brethren and a Mennonite were fighting over the same penny. Now, there's something to be said for frugality, especially living in a world that is obsessed with consumption and excess, which is wasting the earth's valuable resources, polluting the world's precious environment, and creating this great gulf between the haves and the have-nots. Perhaps before long, living a simple and frugal lifestyle will not be simply a matter of choice, but a matter of necessity. But this morning, I'm going to make the case against frugality, at least in one area of our lives. Now, I doubt that any of us would consider ourselves to be living extravagantly. However, there is one area in our lives where extravagance is in order. Back in November, I preached a stewardship sermon about the defining mark of the Christian, which is giving. When the message of what God has done through us in Jesus takes a hold of us, invades every pore of our existence, then we cannot help but be generous people. Now, soon I have always believed in the discipline of tithing. Notice I'm going to say tithing as a baseline of giving. We believe that returning 10% of what God has entrusted to us is not a limit. It is a starting point. Because the more we experience the generosity of God, the more we understand this God of the Scriptures who gives and gives and gives, the more we ourselves will be givers, the more we ourselves will be aware of the needs that exist around us, and the more compelled we will be to be outward focused. And so, as a part of our tithe, we believe it is not only important to support the church, but to support causes outside of the church. And one of the places we try to practice this is at restaurants. And I've tried this myself. Sue is a lot better at it than I am, but I am getting there. Do you know the difference between a brethren and a canoe? The canoe will tip. And brethren are notoriously rotten tippers. Paying for a meal, we reason, is extravagant enough. Some of you may know my son John worked at Biagi's for a couple of years, and he said none of the wait staff wanted to work on Sunday from the noon hour till the middle of the afternoon. Do you know why? Who comes into the restaurant around noon? Many of the church people come in, and he said they are notoriously lousy tippers. And think, what does that tell people who are not Christian, who don't know anything about the church? What does it say about Christians? They chart the giving of tip patterns in that restaurant, and the restaurant is full on Sunday, but you can see the graph goes way down. What does that say about us? The world already sees us as being judgmental and hypocritical people, and now add to that that we are a bunch of tightwads. Now, I used to rationalize my gratuity frugality by thinking that those waiters and waitresses did well enough with the generous tips of others, and besides, the service wasn't all that great, and I had to ask for refills. Well, one night I was eating by myself, and the waitress handed me the check. The meal cost about $8 with tax. It was going to be close to 10, so I gave her a $10 bill. She brought back my loose change. And I thought, well, there's not enough in here for a tip. So I decided I'm going to get up and go to the cashier and break a 10. But then a funny thing happened. This voice, if you want to call it, or I would call this nudge within me, said, give her the 10. I said, wait a minute. 15% of $8 is 120. Give her the 10. Look, I could eat out for two times for that. Give her the 10 and leave. And so I did. You know, in those earlier times, I was one who grumbled about doing such things, but it wouldn't be the last time. There were other little intuitions that have nudged me over the years to sometimes give more in the tip than the cost of the meal, and the nudge said that this man or this woman's living depends upon how you treat him or her. I've had wait staff tell me when I ask about, you know, how do people in general do with tips? They said you would be shocked to know the numbers of people who leave nothing at all. And so I make it a point to be generous and to sense if that waitress is having a hard day or if they look stressed, because there's no telling what difference a generous gratuity can make. I went on a one-day fishing trip to the Mississippi River with a guy named Roger. He was from Iowa, and so on our way back, he wanted to stop at his favorite restaurant. It bore the elegant name of the Machine Shed. It was outside of Davenport, Iowa. If you're ever traveling there, I suggest you go, because their signature dish is this behemoth of a pork chop. It looks more like a small pork roast, and oh, was it good. And I was attacking that thing, and I got about halfway through, and I started to slow down. And then our waitress came and said, would you like me to box that up for you? And I said, yes, please. And she said, you're a wuss. I said, what? She said, you heard me, you're a wuss. I said, well, what do you mean? She said, a guy your size can't eat that piece of meat. You're just a big wussy. Oh. Well, obviously, this spark plug of a gal who stood all of maybe 5 feet tall had a personality that was bigger than life, and again, the nudge spoke to me, only this time it cost me dearly. Give the girl a 20. She called me a wuss. Give her the 20 anyway. I'm not going to be able to eat all this thing. It'll probably go. Give her the 20. And so I did, and we walked out the door, and we were halfway across the parking lot when I heard a voice from behind me at the entrance shout out, thank you, wuss. You made my day. How did it make her day? I have no idea. For Sue and I, 2014 was a year of giving what we could, and it was also a year of giving sometimes what we could not to the church, to Bethany Seminary, to Manchester College, to the denomination, to groups that work for preservation of the environment and wildlife conservation, and waiters and waitresses, and the guy standing outside the Meijer store looking for a handout. You know, I wasn't always a cheerful giver, but I didn't regret it, because I trusted that God could somehow use that offering and do some good by someone. Now, I offer this to you because it is a microcosm of the struggles that all of us have, that tension between two outlooks and two responses to life. In that old hymn, "Christian, Let Your Light Shine," there is that verse that says, "As you travel here below, shed a ray where'er you go." And the ray, of course, is Jesus. It's the light of his love that is embedded in our words and, more importantly, in our deeds that makes the difference. The Christian life, you see, is a luminous life. It is a generous life. And giving is the distinguishing mark. The trouble is that we are, all of us, engaged in a tug of war. A tug of war between the team over here, which has abundance on their t-shirt, and the team over here, which has scarcity written upon theirs. It's the teams of the fear of not having enough, and the awareness that all we have needed, as I said in the prayer, God's hand has provided. And it's that fear that we don't have enough, which of course is that driving force behind our consuming and our hoarding and our grasping and stamping everything with that rubber stamp that says, mine. Now, in our lesson from John, Jesus is called to help with the situation. He's called to bring his saving power to it, but he is not called upon this time to save souls, but to save a wedding reception. The wine was running out. Jesus and his mother and his disciples were guests at that wedding, and so Mary goes to her son and said, "The wine is running out. Perhaps you could do something about it." And when you read that response of Jesus, it is very terse. Jesus is obviously perturbed. He said, "Why should I do something about it? Woman," not mother, "woman." I mean, I'd get smacked in the face if I would have said that to my mother when I was growing up. And maybe he said, "Well, the stewards should have done a better job planning. Besides, it's obvious, isn't it, that they've had enough to drink already?" You see, Jesus was being protective at this point. This is very early. Indeed, this is at the start of his ministry. And he said to his mother, "My hour has not come." He didn't feel that it was the right time to be having this display of power and have the word leak out as to who he really was. But he had a change of heart, and he turned 180 gallons of water into some mighty fine wine. And the guests, who were accustomed to always drinking the best wine first, such that they would get a little happy and not notice the inferior wine that was served later, were marveling at the fine vintage. And John says this was the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and the disciples believed in him. Okay, what did they believe? John doesn't tell us. And as I thought about it, maybe it wasn't any particular one thing they believed, because remember, this is at the beginning of his ministry. And maybe it was John's way of saying this was the first step in a gradual process of believing. For he would tell his disciples later in John, "I have come to you that you may have abundant life." In chapter 15, he said, "These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full." In Luke, he says, "Give and it shall be given to you, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and overflowing will be placed in your lap, because the measure you give shall be the measure you receive." So what does turning water into wine have to do with us? Well, I think that it is this. That act of Jesus is a symbol for us of turning want into plenty and scarcity into abundance. Didn't he say, don't worry where your next meal is coming from? Don't worry that you are not up with the fashions of the world. Trust God with the necessities, because you see, when we want what God wants for the world, we will understand that God has provided this magnificent abundance for us with everything we need to live. I recall meeting with a family to plan their mother's funeral. And in our discussion, they kept coming back to something their mother, Helen, would often say. I don't have much, but I have more than enough. And as I thought about it, I said, we ought to tattoo that to the inside of our eyelids. We don't have much, but it's more than enough. I love that, but the more I thought about it, the first half of it was wrong. The part that said we don't have much, because she and we have so very, very much. Because there is a pipeline that feeds our culture. It's not just oil that flows through it, but a disproportionate amount of the Earth's resources. I think the last time I checked, this figure is still accurate, that we in the United States comprise 6% of the world's population, yet we consume over 40% of the world's resources. And that doesn't leave a whole lot for the rest of the world now, does it? We are consumed with much and with many. The news broadcasts the stories of these idiots who camp out for 2 days in front of Best Buy waiting for the newest technological toy to go on sale. And as we sleep, there are brilliant, creative people looking for ways to turn us into customers, and they know that the more stuff we have, the more stuff we want, because the more we want, we never have enough. Now, I'm going to make an assumption this morning, and that is that we believe what the Bible says. Generally speaking, we believe that a good God created the good world, that we believe that this good God created us in love. We believe that we are born into abundance and promised the love of Jesus, from which nothing shall separate us. We believe that. But as the Old Testament professor Walter Brueggemann said, we read the Bible on a good day, but we watch Nike advertisements every day. And the story of Nike is the story that says it's all about our achievement, and it's all about what we create for ourselves. Brueggemann said that he and his wife have young friends who have a 4-year-old son. And they confessed to Brueggemann that they were feeling very anxious and stressed about a crucial decision they were making for their son. They were concerned that they were going to get him into the very best kindergarten. Because if he didn't go to a good kindergarten, then he wouldn't make it into a good prep school. And if he didn't get admitted to a good prep school, he wouldn't be admitted to Davidson College. And if he wasn't admitted to Davidson College, then he wouldn't be connected with the bankers in Charlotte and be able to get a job and make a lot of money. The fear is, he's not going to have enough. They obsess over, unless he has the very, very best that the world has to offer, that he is simply not going to make it. Years ago, a woman gave me a soul-searching piece that is called You Are So Blessed. And I want you to listen to it. If you woke up this morning with more health than illness, then you are more blessed than the million people who will not make it through the week. If you have never experienced the danger of war, the loneliness of imprisonment, the horror of torture and the pangs of starvation, then you are ahead of 20 million people who live in this world. If you attend church without the fear of harassment and arrest and torture and even death, then you are more blessed than 3 billion people in this earth. If you have food in your refrigerator, clothes on your back, a roof over your head, and a place to sleep, you are already richer than 75% of the world. If you have money in the bank and in your wallet and in that little dish on the dresser, then you are among the top eight most wealthy people in the world. If your parents are still alive and married, you are very rare, especially in the United States. If you hold up your head with a smile on your face and are truly thankful, you are blessed because the majority can, but most do not. If you can hold someone's hand, hug them, and touch their shoulder, you are blessed because you can offer God's healing touch. You know, we all are awash in abundance that most people in the world simply cannot fathom, and yet we think we need more and deserve more and are entitled to more. Like someone said, our attitudes and eyes blinded to abundance see so much scarcity and create so much waste. And so back and forth, we are pulled in that tug of war between having enough of the old siren song that scares us into believing that there aren't enough good things in this world to go around. Okay, 15% of $8 is $1.20. Give her the 10. Then the nudge says, give the girl a 20. She called me a wuss. Give her the 20 anyway. About 3 weeks ago, you said yes. All of you said yes. No dissenting votes to the church's financial plan for ministry for 2014. On that day, you expressed your commitment to support Lincolnshire, not just with your money, but with your very selves. And that, my friends, was the easy part. That was a lead pipe cinch to do that, but now comes tug of war time. Between those voices in our head that says, it's not enough, I can't do it, it's a tug of war between the spiritual purposes to which we are called, on the one hand, and to be with the risk-averse team, on the other hand, that dwells with being realistic in the bottom line. You see, it all comes down to this. Do you believe that Jesus turned water into wine? Do you believe that Jesus turns our want into plenty? Do you trust that God is a God of abundance? Do you really believe that God provides? Do we believe that God gives us every means to do what God wants done? Or do we still think there's only so much to go around?